Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Build
Film
Conversation. Hooray!
Yeah.
So it's podcast time once again. Hello, I'm Richard Nicholas, and with me is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
Anthony Evans.
Kiss kiss.
And Jimmy Thomas, is this what you're setting up?
I don't know. Yeah, bang, bang.
Wow, that was poor.
What I should have done is Mick Foley.
It was like I was going for like a kiss of introduction. Kiss, kiss.
Oh my because God. You're so cosmopolitan.
Exactly. Very European.
Well, if we are going with that, Anthony's already foreshadowed the film we're doing this week on the podcast, and that is the slightly dubious titled Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang. I don't even like saying it. It's one of those ones you wouldn't want to go up to the cinema counter thing and go, the cinema counter thing? What the fuck's that? You wouldn't want to ask for two tickets to Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang, please. Because it sounds a little bit like a softcore pornography.
Yeah.
It's just grubby. And like the double, like if it was called Kiss, Bang, it would sound wrong. Well, it's horrible. It's a really horrible title.
I think originally it was supposed to just be called Bang with an exclamation point. And I think Val Kilmer actually suggested Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is the alternate song that Shirley Bassey did for Thunderball before they went with Tom Jones doing Thunderball.
Ooh, fun fact. It also kind of sounds like the sexual version of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I'm pretty sure that one of the James Bond films, I want to say in Japan, where they all have mad titles, one of them is known as Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Maybe it's just an Ian Fleming thing. He wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Bond, so maybe... The title isn't growing on me, but...
Oh, no.
It is what it is. That's the film we got to deal with. And it was Abby's pick. And she didn't pick it because it's got a stupid title, did you, Abby? Why did you pick it?
I picked it because it's Robert Downey Jr.'s turn on my carousel of watching things.
The title is going to be so good. The Carousel of Potential Actors to View or something.
If you give me a minute, I can say it again and it'll be better.
No, you called it what you called it. Downey Jr. came up on your people to give a look at Omitter. I can't do it either. You fancied looking at a Downey Jr. film?
I did.
And why this one?
Well, this film has a little bit of history for me and Rich, at least, where I kept picking it up in shops and Rich kept going, no, I don't get that, and making me put it down again.
Judge a book by its title, or rather judge a DVD by its title is how I felt about it. That's all. The cover's a little bit... It's like kind of different because it's like got two outlines of the main characters with more pictures within their outlines. It's kind of blue, orange and white. It's kind of different looking DVD. But it's still called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which makes me go, no, back on the shelf.
Yeah, you're prejudiced.
Shame on you, Richard.
So eventually I think I bought it despite you. And then watched it and went, ha, this is actually good in your face.
Ha ha ha, Rich. Well done. You now like a film. Oh no, you've really shown me. Yeah, it's good. I liked it once we'd watched it and I'd got over my prejudice. And it's been a while, though. I haven't watched it since probably we bought it in the OEs. Mid-OEs.
Although we all did recently go and see the film The New Guys, which shares
The Nice Guys.
Nice Guys, right. Sorry. The New Guys. The Nice Guys, anyway. And it shares a lot of similarities with it.
Ah, this is what we should have done. Good reminder, Anthony. Yeah, the Nice Guys was good, but it was by Shane Black, who we haven't mentioned yet because I forgot we're meant to give the listeners a clue as to who made it and who's in it. So, Abby, if you could, please tell us who made and stars in the film.
I will. Just for you. So, this is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang from 2005. It's directed by Shane Black. It's written by Shane Black, but based partly on a book by Brett Halliday called Bodies Are Where You Find Them.
Already a better title.
It stars Robert Downey Jr., Val Kilmer, Michelle Monaghan, and then a bit Corbin Benson and Larry Miller.
Actually, Bodies Where You Bodies Are Where You Find Them is again a weird title. Like I'd prefer to ask for that, but it's a weird thing to say. Mm. We're not going to get into a book review, but that is an odd way to phrase it. But, you know, that's the Kiss Kiss. Just in case you were thinking, how many of the Kiss Kiss Bang Bang films do we have to narrow it down to? That's the one.
So as we were saying, it's directed by Shane Black, who also did Nice Guys, also did Lethal Weapon.
And some of its sequels.
Iron Man 3, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yes, and also The Long Kiss Goodnight, which we featured you on Spoiler Filled.
Ah, and another Kiss film for some reason.
Yes.
Doesn't feature the band Kiss, though.
Thank fuck.
Yeah. They have merchandise pretty much everything. I think I am a Kiss merchandise officially. That's how many things there are. I mean, what do you think of Shane Black then, Abby? You already said, you know, Anthony already mentioned we just went to see The Nice Guys and all kind of liked it. But what did you, like, know about him before you saw this film?
I don't think I even knew he existed.
Well, you'd seen Lethal Weapon, presumably.
Not in any way that I actually committed it to memory. It was one of those films that I probably saw on TV at some point and wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, sort of one of those fluffy action movies from the 80s and 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, so despite seeing it, I probably couldn't have told you anything about it.
Buddies fight crime ridiculously.
But of all his things that I've seen, I like them all. So, yeah, that's good.
High praise. I'm going to ask you, Anthony, seeing as you've already chirped up a bit about liking The Nice Guys, which is now presumably out of the cinema by the time this podcast gets posted. Shane Black, this film, speak aloud.
That's okay. I think I can't remember if Shane Black was on my radar before I watched this film. Like, I saw this more or less when it first came out. And I can't remember whether I was aware of Shane Black before this and I went to see it because of that, or whether I became aware of him because of this. But since then, it's like, oh, this was an interesting film. So I kind of look up the back catalogue. You're like, wow, he did this. Wow, he did this. Oh, my God, he did this. I mentioned we did The Long Kiss Goodnight, but I was unable to be part of that one because I think I was away at the time. And it was a great shame because I really love that film and subsequently have come to love a lot of Shane Black's screenplays. Mm. I think there's The Last Action Hero, Lethal Weapon, The Last Boy Scout. And he's just a very fun writer who likes to kind of play with conventions.
He's got a good ear for dialogue as well.
Yeah,
very
too,
funny action movies with they always feel like they're a movie. Like we're making a movie. We're not ashamed of that. Let's do what we do with that genre and let's do what you can do with that medium, you know?
Yeah. So they tend to get a little self-referential and they kind of play with cliches and conventions. And I enjoy that in the film. And like you said, Abby, it's exceptionally funny dialogue. I don't want to say naturalistic, but very realistic. Like, you would imagine people would speak to each other in real life.
Everyone wishes they could talk.
Yeah, it's like they've dialed the banter levels up a bit. Everyone's a bit wittier and cooler than reality, but they do talk a lot.
Yeah, so this guy was working in Hollywood before Tarantino, and I can't help but think that over the years, maybe they've kind of influenced each other in terms of, writing screenplays.
Maybe.
Because they have a very similar thing of they write fantastic dialogue that you wish you had the eloquence to come up with yourself kind of thing.
And luckily someone will fire a gun at some point and make it exciting as well.
Indeed. Shane Black, thumbs up. I've liked his stuff so far. This was his directorial debut. And it did come about 8 years after his last screenplay. Because I think The Last Kiss Goodnight, even though we all enjoyed it here at Spoiler Filled, I think it kind of bombed at the box office. I think he was a bit of a pariah for a while. And then this was his kind of comeback.
Yeah. It's a shame he went away, really, because I would have happily have filled that gap with more of his films, but whatever. Let's ask Jamie. Jamie, what were you expecting from this film?
I actually didn't know. This is one of those films that I had repeatedly heard of over and over again and never seen anything to do with it, except for one very brief clip of Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr., the bit where Robert Downey Jr. accidentally shoots a guy in the head, trying to be all cool and Russian roulette-y and just immediately kills him.
The 8% bit.
Yeah. And I saw that clip ages ago and thought, oh, that actually looks funnier than I thought it would from, like, what vague knowledge I have of it, and then I just never watched it. Mm. And I think that's the general consensus of just what happened with the film, at least in the US, because I know it did a lot better outside of the US than domestically. And I know it got shopped around a lot, and nobody kind of wanted to pick it up because it's such a... Like, it was made in 2005, and it didn't cash in on anything that was currently happening in cinema. It's just kind of this personal, like, little passion project of Shane Black's.
Yeah, because it wasn't that vogue to do modern noirs back then in the Middle East.
I did... it was interesting, though, but and I didn't realise this until I watched it and started to pick up on it, and then when I looked it up, it confirmed it. But it was heavily influenced by and kind of deliberately skewed towards Raymond Chandler's writing, which is where The Singing Detective came from. And then Robert Downey Jr. was in a really awful movie remake of The Singing Detective, which was a fantastic BBC miniseries in the 80s with Michael Gambon. And the film was terrible, but tonally, it was actually quite similar to this, if more surreal. And Robert Downey Jr. was really good in it, despite how bad it was.
Abby, you checked this out as a kind of exploring Downey Jr.'s back catalogue. But do you agree with Jamie, or...?
It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't good.
It wasn't as good as the Michael Gambon original.
I walked on the clip where it's obviously established that the detective was kind of... physically fucked up in some way, and I was just like, not watching this ever.
I think it's the part of the problem is that the film with Robert Downey Jr. is a single film, whereas the TV miniseries has a lot more room to breathe and explore a lot of the concepts that I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it now, and he's like one of the best TV writers there ever was.
Quickly type it in.
I am.
Led it closer to you saying.
No, it's fine. We can be shoddy in this. It makes us really.
Oh yeah, we let people behind the curtain so much. I kind of wonder why do we have curtains at all.
Dennis Potter. Dennis Potter was a very good TV writer who had and The Singing Detective in particular was based very heavily on his own experiences as a writer. And I think that is lost in the Downey Jr. film, which is a shame. But Downey Jr. is really good in it. And it was around the time, it was 2003, so it was 2 years before this film. And it was around the time that Robert Downey Jr. started to kind of pick up momentum again as an actor, because he'd very much been kind of forgotten about because of a lot of his personal problems.
Yeah, it's odd to think now that Downey Jr. wasn't this massively popular guy like he is now, because he hadn't had the Iron Man success. He hadn't got his name to be big. Like now, everyone knows who he is. But there was a time where you'd be like, oh, Downey Jr., you might have heard of him, you might have not. Isn't he that guy in Weird Science? God, that's a shit film.
Yeah.
His name wasn't synonymous with blockbuster movie star greatness.
He had a lot of sort of addiction problems, and I think Kiss Kiss Bang Bang I think was the first film that he did having become totally sober, and Val Kilmer actually, as a show of solidarity, didn't drink or anything the whole time they were filming it.
Cute.
Which probably helped Val Kilmer lose a little bit more weight, because Max tubby in this film, and he lost 50 pounds to be in this.
He looks all right in it, I thought.
Oh, no,
What's great about his character is he's called Gay Perry, which I think isn't that what they call the capital of France?
Gay Paris, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, is that meant to be a pun, or am I just reaching?
No, it's deliberate, I think. But I want to get on to Val Kilmer as soon as we can, because he's great in this. Yeah.
So, a bit, you know, you'd filled in a blank that had been long missing as well.
Yeah, I kind of had no expectations. I didn't really know who Shane Black was. It's like everyone else. I've seen his films without knowing who he was.
Sure.
And I think it's actually Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in particular reminded me a lot of Edgar Wright's more recent... It reminded me a lot of Hot Fuzz, which came out, I think, a year or two after Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, like 2006 or 2007.
It's that film literacy, like being aware of movies, conventions, fucking with them, having some fun, but also doing a genre, just doing a straight comedy.
Something that I think this film does very well in a very similar way to Hot Fuzz, taking really over-the-top film situations and putting reasonably real characters in there. So that they just kind of fumble their way through these, like, absurd situations.
That was, actually, having watched The Nice Guys, I'm not going to give too much spoilers away for that, but essentially all that happens is the main characters fall through every situation, sometimes literally. Everything they investigate, it just happens to them rather than them successfully being investigators. And this whole film is about Private Eye. I guess it's not about... It's about a duo between a Private Eye and
you've got Robert Downey
Jr. kind of a thief turn actor turn, like he's not anything. He's like, he starts off Robert Downey Jr. as a guy called Harry who's robbing a shop. It's probably one of the best like setups to a film because his starting role has nothing to do with what he's doing the whole film. So he's robbing a place. He's running from the cops. His partner's been shot by a crazy person who like leans out a window and like screams at them. And then he finds himself in an audition room, and because he's so frightened and the script sort of, you know, serendipitously lines up with what's happened to him, he gives a really amazing performance reading the lines and reacting, and he gets cast and shipped off to LA from New York where the film starts. And it's just, wait, so he's a thief? Right, but he's in LA, and now he's trying for a part in a film, and it's all about the coincidences and the death of a person . It really gets going in a different direction.
What's really nice is that it has Robert Downey Jr. narrate it in very much the same way you just did, where he sort of haphazardly explains bits and pieces and forgets things and is like, oh, shit, sorry, I forgot the other bit. Like, it works because just where you find yourself at a point in the story where you're wondering, hang on, where did this come from? He stops the film and says... Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot. There's also this other thing, which I thought was... it is one of the few problems I had with the film, is that kind of falls by the wayside.
Well, here's the thing. The film starts off going, hey, this is a knowing film. The narrator is the main character, and he is going to break the fourth wall, and they kind of fake stopping the film, because if the film stopped... the narration would stop, but like they pretend freeze the frames, like it's like as if it's a reel. And Downey Jr. sort of tells you directly the viewer that he's like going to go back and tell you something else, and like he's kind of self evaluating as he narrates. It's very knowing and it's very funny, but it's actually I found it a bit too like it was trying too hard to be witty and off the wall. Like initially I was a bit this is a bit grating. Like you're trying too hard to be cool and knowing. And you're right, though, it didn't consistently, like, towards the end of the film, it's trying to explain the mystery so much, it doesn't have time to do weird stuff breaking out of the film, you know?
I think, I guess it gets all of my criticisms out of the way early on. I think my only real problem with this film is related to that, in that it becomes a little bit convoluted, and not necessarily because... the plot is overly complicated, but because it focuses, I don't really know how to explain it, that it focuses maybe a little bit too much on certain things while neglecting other things. So you have a couple of scenes or sequences where everybody remembers that they're involved in the plot and everything has to come together very quickly. But I think it deflates the film a little bit, which is a shame because it's, for the most part, it's really strong and has a lot of momentum. And then it kind of slows down. But then it picks back up again really well, sort of towards the end.
Yeah, it's an exciting film, and I like it's slightly complicated because it's a noir thriller, in a sense. Like it's a complicated genre because it's a noir thriller, but it's modern and self-referential and a comedy. It's like it's aware of itself.
I think
it's trying to be funny, but it's trying to play with the conventions of like noirish pulp books and films, and be modern and be funny, and it's maybe you know. It's not as you know well put together as it could be, especially given the story's quite hard to follow the first time round. It's like, wait, so that person's dead, but now they're here, and they're not the person we thought initially. And you know, it's kind of like you're trying to piece it together anyway.
It's definitely a film that I would watch again and probably enjoy more with subsequent watches. Now that I know what happens, it's one of those films that benefits from spoilers because things start
Hooray,
to make sense.
Because that's what we're doing.
There's a lot of plot to get through, and I don't know. It's hard to kind of go in and go. Oh, I could have done it better if I'd done this.
No, of course.
I'm not saying
it needs to be better, and I'm not saying I could correct it. I'm just saying how I felt reacting to it. Abby, what do you think of all this kind of clever, knowing filmmaking and whatnot? It started off with.
It did tap dance the line a little bit where they did it just enough so that it was engaging and funny, but I think, like you mentioned, they do let it go and you sort of miss it a bit, but if they had done it too much and crossed the line too far, it really would have been to the detriment of the film.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to judge.
Anthony, would you have liked them to play around more with what they started off doing, or not? Or do you sort of disagree, or what?
I agree to a certain extent. I can't help but think that a lot of the kind of convoluted nature of the plot is a bit of an in-joke, because with these kind of mystery thrillers, they're constantly kind of throwing you kind of red herrings and plot twists, and it's meant to be kind of confusing, and it's supposed to kind of entice you into, like, okay, I've got to know what happens at the end now, kind of thing. And I think, you know, it does that. There is a point where you kind of do lose it. It does, after a while, get a bit, like, we were saying, like, he writes really good dialogue, but, like, there is so much of it after a while that you can't help but feel like they're being a bit smarmy at times.
Yeah, it's a bit clever, a bit snarky.
Yeah, a bit smart-ass, yeah.
Yeah.
But overall, it is kind of really just entertaining and fun.
I think Anthony has a good point there in that this is maybe why it didn't do so well, particularly domestically in the US, is it's very, very specific with what it's referencing and what it's aping, the whole Raymond Chandler film noir detective thing. And I do think that that is probably part of why that it's deliberate that the plot is as complex as it is, and things happen as revelations as it goes on, because that's very much within the genre of those kind of detective sort of mystery novels.
Yes. But, well, this is the thing that we've got going on. We've got an actor playing an actor in a film about a film genre, but also, like, the plot involves a Pulp Fiction book series that doesn't exist. It's trying to reflect Pulp Fiction books. The very story itself is like a pulp investigation novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's parodying a book that's made up within the film, like that's a pastiche of real life pulp noir novels, and it also features an actor who had played a character from the book series. So there's so many little layers of, oh well, it's like clever, but at the same time you do start to lose. Wait, by the end you're like, well, what was the baddie's motivation?
Do you know what it is?
He murdered someone, or what?
There's a reason it got a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival. This is a film for film nerds.
More
than anyone else, and I think that's totally fine, and it does it very well. And I also think that it did it maybe without the intention of necessarily having mass appeal. Like, it seems more of a personal project than anything else.
But it's got loads of cool action stuff. Like, people get shot. There's crashes and chases. There's loads of conventional blockbuster stuff in there. It's not trying to be too thinky or clever.
No, it. I think it does balance it very well. And there's a lot of the comedy in it is really on point. There are so many situations that are almost... I feel really... Like, Robert Downey Jr. as an actor has a really good way of being an everyman, even when he's clearly not. Even as Tony Stark, he comes across as... He reacts in the way a normal person would to really bizarre situations.
He is relatable.
And the scene that was brilliant was him going for a piss and finding a corpse in the shower.
Yeah.
And in his shock, pissing all over the corpse. Like, that was...
Yeah, because it's proper stupid comedy, but at the same time, his reaction is like, God, yeah, it's like, that's... Like, yeah. What Panic. Do you say in this situation?
And then telling Val Kilmer, I pissed on the corpse.
Yeah, and it's that kind of level of farcical stuff happening, but the way the characters react is relatable, so it doesn't seem ridiculous. I mean, it is, but like the whole film, if you look at what happens, it's totally off the wall and filmic and silly. But because the characters are kind of likable and believable, you let it happen, and you don't, you know, you enjoy it. And that's really effective. Actually, one of the things it does really well is plays with the conventions of movies and tropes of films. Like, you mentioned one example, I think, where Downey Jr. is like confidently going to play Russian roulette to intimidate a guy. And he shoots him and the bullet hits him in the head. It's like, that never happens in a film because there's no drama. Unless there's a click and doesn't go off. And of course, you know, there's a good chance, and it's not 8%. There's a good chance you're going to shoot someone in the face. So play Russian roulette.
It was such a great sort of reaction from Val Kilmer's art. Who taught you math? Stop multiplying.
There's lots of examples. Like, can anyone else think of like a moment where they kind of fuck with the trope of what would normally happen?
There's a kind of the first thing that comes to my mind is just kind of the ending where he has a bit of a speech about like Hollywood executives changing the ending of films.
Yeah.
So it's a bit happier. Yeah. Mm.
Abraham Lincoln comes in with all these dead cast members.
Yeah, I liked how they brought Val Kilmer in and they said, this doesn't normally, like you say, Anthony, it doesn't normally a film wouldn't wrap up as neatly as this, but producers. But, and they bring all back all the dead people plus Abe Lincoln, but then they get rid of them again. And it is just Val Kilmer. And he's trying to tell you this really, no, this is how it happened. You're like, no, it didn't. This is a film. You know that.
I got another one.
Yeah.
On. There's like a bit at the beginning where he kind of, Downey Jr. starts picking a fight with a guy who looks like he's kind of taking advantage of a woman, and he's doing that kind of tough guy act, and it looks like he's going to kind of beat up the guy, and then cut to the next scene, and he's just kind of like having the shit kicked out of him on the floor.
Yeah. And then the guy gets to go off with the woman anyway, and it's just, it takes those things you don't even notice are tropes in films, and then just goes, wouldn't it be funny if this happened, and like it doesn't go the way of the movie, you know?
That actually reminds me of something that I liked in this film, and it's a strange little character trait that Robert Downey Jr. has, but it's something you don't see very often, especially in sort of action or spy movies or anything like that. Is Robert Downey Jr.'s weird nervousness about accidentally inappropriately touching women?
Yeah,
and he's always covering them up and protecting their modesty and. Yeah, that situation where he finds that guy touching her up while she's passed out, and he's like, "Hey, I'm a fuck you up," and then he gets his head kicked in.
Yeah.
But also, when they find the body in the lake, and he pulls her skirt down, he is trying to kill the spider that has climbed into that I can't remember her character,
Harmony's
bra. And then she thinks he grabbed her tit, and she says, it's fine, it happens. It's like, what? No, you can't just let it go. Like that.
Big argument about the nature of whether that's okay or not. And then, you know, there's a lot more comedy from it. And it's interesting you say about the way he treats women. It's because another trope it bucks the trend of is the idea that, so in every noir film, there's a femme fatale. And in this one, like, he tries to sleep with her. And, you know, it's like a past relationship that he's trying to rekindle. And then it seems like it's going that way where they're getting on and they're friends. And then he ends up, we cut to him having slept with the best friend who didn't like him at all. And he runs out and has to apologise and she's not having it. And it's just like, this is more, like, it's not like real life, but it's much funnier to exploit the opposite of what would normally happen and kind also, of make a kind of joke of it all.
Another great moment, which is one of my favourites, is as once the plot has kicked off and her sister has died and it seems like she's killed herself and then they think she hasn't and it turns out at the end that she did, but there's that scene where she's having a meltdown in front of him, but also her nipple has slipped out of her top.
And so he's not really listening.
Yeah, and it's the fact that he's just staring at her nipple while she just goes on and on. And it actually gives a lot of depth to his character because he's doing something that most normal straight guys would have a really hard time, you know, not looking. Even if it's not necessarily a sexual thing, it's like, how do I tell her that she's in the middle of a rant and she's falling? But it's that versus him then protecting her modesty.
Yeah.
And it gives him a lot of depth because he's obviously attracted to her, but at the same time, he's scared to do anything in case it's inappropriate. And I thought that's just a really interesting tick to give a character in a film like this. Because normally, you know, you have a guy like James Bond or whoever, even Indiana Jones or whatever, they're always, jumping from woman to woman and all that stuff.
I think maybe it worked against the film a bit in America, perhaps, because there's no escapism in this man. There's just, he's just a guy,
And it's not like that Woody Allen extreme kind of nervous. It's not about being a crap guy. When Woody Allen is trying to take a kind of Humphrey Bogart approach to meeting women, it's not like those type of films. It's more in the middle than that, and I think it's more relatable.
What's nice is that they do stuff like that with him without he comes across as kind of the loser, but he never comes across necessarily as pathetic. He's not unlikable. He's just a normal kind of not slow, but like he's not. Well, no, I guess he is. That's the other interesting thing, is that he is, it turns out he's actually a really gifted detective. By accident.
Hang on,
He just has a knack for it.
His way of detecting things is he hurts his finger, he gets his finger chopped off in a doorway because he's caused an argument, and by going to the hospital, that sets up a chain of events that clues him in. So this is the kind of a trope of Black's movies, I think, that he sort of likes characters that start off trying to do their job properly, but end up falling through all of the story and being victims of what's happening. And it's all very serendipitous.
That was also another one of my favourite scenes, where she smashes his finger off in the door.
And it's just, that wouldn't happen in a normal investigation movie, because it's too...
Yeah.
It kind of fucks the plot up normally, but in this case, it's what the plot needs to do to progress the story. It's cracking in that. There's lots of things, when you think about them, they were really unusual options to go for. But because in a sense, it's a screenwriter writing a film that's deliberately meant to be a film. So it's everything that would normally be the wrong thing to do in a script, you could just write it so it's the right thing to happen. It's kind of...
It does that thing that, and I mean, I know this was made in 2005, but it does a thing that a lot of films did in the 90s, a lot of sort of major comedy films like the first Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber, kind of, The Big Lebowski, even stuff like Beavis and Butthead Do America, is that they will take unlikely characters and put them in a really cliche kind of action or caper kind of plot. And the films that I mentioned range from terrible to great, but that's the basis of them. And this is very similar in that it takes an ostensibly normal guy and puts him in a really, really cliche film noir plot, but his reactions to all of it are not the cliches.
Yeah, he's not Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
You know, and everything that happens to him, he's not doing it. He doesn't succeed at any point. And, what's interesting is we've got an actual detective who isn't the full focus. And, like, Val Kilmer plays Perry as... Occasionally, they got, like, a kind of slightly cleverer gay joke every now and again. But fundamentally, he's a competent detective who's teaching Downey Jr., who's going to be playing a detective in a film because he's been cast off the back of his kind of weird situation at the start. So the idea is they're together because he's a method actor, or supposed to be, and Val Kilmer's going to take him on his jobs. And then, you know, through that, as we watch the film, we discover that he wasn't really going to be in the film. And they kind of do a nice in-joke about how they were just wanted to get the price of Colin Farrell down. And it makes you wonder, did they actually pitch this film to Colin Farrell? And he was too expensive?
But they did pitch it to, I think it was Benicio Del Toro. And then Harrison Ford was one of the casting choices for Gay Perry.
That would have been well weird.
But you brought it up now, so we need to talk about Val Kilmer in this.
Go on, yeah.
Because Val Kilmer is one of those actors who everyone dislikes for no particular reason. And everyone talks about Val Kilmer like he's terrible and has been forever. And I've never really had a problem with him. I even like him in Batman Forever. If anything, I think he's the only thing I like about Batman Forever. Because he plays an interesting take on, like, he makes it his own. Like, he kind of does a mix of straight man Batman, borderline Adam West. And he makes Bruce Wayne out to almost be this autistic, emotionally stunted weirdo.
What I would say is any feelings you have now on Batman Forever, we now have to cut out of this podcast and stick in the very first episode we ever did. Weren't you, Jamie? So I'll take that. I'll leave it there. You've expressed your like of Val Kilmer in that role. But what do you think causes people to dislike him? Because I personally don't care one way or the other about him. Like, I don't think he's great or bad, but I don't think I've seen that many films of his.
No, I haven't. Like, I've seen, Top Gun, Batman Forever, Heat. I've seen an awful film that he was in a few years ago, which is a horror movie. And I don't remember what it was called, but it was fucking dreck. It was him as he's like an avenging angel ghost demon thing who haunts a police station. And that is actually the only film that he's shit in, but it's not because of him, it's because the film is shit and he obviously just cannot be asked.
I can hear Anthony taking notes to write that. Yeah. Suggest that for a future spoiler film.
It would possibly be a spoiler film, but it's not as interesting as it sounds. It's really fucking boring. And also, he looks like he weighs a ton in it. He's one of those actors who I think people just assume he's terrible.
Well, I put him in the same category as John Travolta. There's some great films he's in that are fine and that stand him up as a good actor, but then he's in lots of terrible dreck. He's not bankable, you know, but you wouldn't say don't put him in it.
I think that might be the other thing with Val Kilmer, is that because he was, a pretty boy and he was one of those ones that, like, Hollywood grabbed hold of and tried to push him as a leading man rather than just kind of letting him do his own thing. When he's kind of left alone to do Stranger Things, he's fine. Like, he's very good in The Doors, which I haven't seen, but I've seen clips of him playing Jim Morrison. But this was at a point in his career where he'd almost become, Val Kilmer. He really embraces this character, but what's great about it is that he doesn't play him gay. Like,
it's just a little bit of nuanced, campness, but fundamentally, he's like a straight guy to. I mean, I don't mean an awkward term, but he's the straight guy to Downey Jr.'s feckless, useless, character.
The idea of him being gay isn't really... It's not made a joke... Like, he's not made a joke of because he's gay. They make gay jokes in reference to him, but he's not the joke. He isn't incompetent. Yeah. He's not... This isn't like Robin Williams in The Birdcage.
We've reviewed that as well. We talked about it in a comment or something. You're saying you liked him in this role and you liked the way they told the story of Gay Perry or Perry.
I liked the reasonable amount of respect they treat the idea. They don't use the gay thing necessarily as a novelty. It is just part of his character, and he embraces it very well.
You don't tend to see a kind of a gay character, like a competent gay character, in an action film.
I think he was the first. If I, according to the trivia, on IMDb, he is the
he's the first competent gay detective in a movie.
He's the first openly gay character in a leading role in an action movie. And I also like the fact that he's genuinely quite threatening at times, and also gigantic. I think part of it is his, because, you know, Val Kilmer has now notoriously struggled with and put on a lot of weight. Part of it is because it looks like he just doesn't give a shit anymore. He's like, hey, fat, happy Val Kilmer. But it kind of adds to the role in this, because he looks like someone who in his youth was very fit and has just gotten older and tubbier, but is still...
I don't know. I think you're being particularly bitchy by worrying. I don't think he can, like, he wasn't like even a fat character. He was just a little bit... He showed a little bit compared to his past, but...
I get what Jimmy means, though. He does look like a man who's had to spend a lot of time sitting in a car, waiting for someone to come out of an office.
Yeah,
he looks like a guy who used to be a good detective and now works in Hollywood. He just looks right for the role that it is.
Yeah, it's just, and it makes him look. It sounds weird, but it almost makes him look like a more of a mentor figure by him being slightly heavier, because it ages him a little bit. But it also, literally as well as figuratively, gives weight to him. He has a presence in the film. He has a really big, heavy presence that makes him seem powerful. And I was surprised at how intimidating he could actually be.
And what's nice, for the first half of the film, he doesn't really give a fuck about this Harry guy.
I love how much he pokes fun at him.
Yeah, he mocks him. One of my favourite moments is Harry's accepting the thing he thinks that his childhood romance that he's hooked up with again has killed herself, and he's grieving and leaning against Val Kilmer's car, and Val Kilmer's like, oh, I'm sorry for you, even though we were just having a row, I gotta go though. Yeah, I gotta go. And he like just shoves his head off the car. Yeah. I like that there's an animosity between the two male leads, and then but once they establish the roles a bit, and we get where the film's going, it's more of an investigation. It's kind of a caper, and once they throw in this female character who isn't dead, which is kind of the love interest, the femme fatale, it becomes three people all struggling to investigate the same conspiracy, murder, cover up thing. Abby, it's your film. What would you like to discuss?
Well, first, I want to agree with Jamie in that I don't know what people got against Val Kilmer either. I haven't seen loads of his films, but all the stuff I've seen of him, I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely fine, quite good, even.
I don't know if it's a kind of audience thing, but he's definitely like gained a reputation as being a little hard to work with. So maybe it stems from that rather than from his actual performances.
Oh, maybe.
Well, whatever it is, you're on board with him in this role as Gay Perry. So, and we've already established, we all like Danny Jr. We like Gay Perry's character. Do we like the femme fatale character? Abby, you lead us. I don't want to hijack it already.
You mean Harmony?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think so. Because the difficulty is the sort of character that she is playing. There are some elements of a character that are difficult to like. So,
sure.
Like, she's... How can I put this now?
Promiscuous?
That wasn't what I was going to say first, but yeah, that's in there. But she's also an actress trying to make it in Hollywood based on what she looks like.
Yeah, I get you.
So there's always that sort of... She's aware of how attractive she is and that she has to capitalise on that for her work.
Yeah, but she's also aware that that's the situation, and like she's not like naive and like a dummy. She's aware she's aging, and that to be trying to get into work with her looks is not an option now that she's getting older. But she also has a problem that her sister they can't even understand the plot still. Like I'm trying, there's no easy way to say there is a dead woman who's mistaken several times. She's related to a character who's... Like, the dead woman is paying for part of the investigation. I just can't get a sentence out that says some bloke murders someone, tries to cover it up. I can't do it.
Because there's too many corpses.
It's not what... You know, there's that rule that people say, you know, if you come up with a story or a script or whatever, you have to be able to sum it up
in a sentence. Not even in a long sentence. I can't do it. Anthony, can you do it?
Yeah.
Can you say what the... Now that we've all seen it, what is the investigation?
I'll give it a go. essentially, a TV producer tries to, his daughter is trying to take away his money, so he comes up with a scheme to murder her and get an imposter to pose as her so that doesn't happen, and then he ends up dispatching her as well.
But there's also incest.
It falls apart. Every time you're confident, you say something like a producer. Okay, so a producer is trying to cover up
Then the kind of the suicide, like her sister, is a kind of a red herring.
Yeah.
Because it does relate to, but it's also not related to the actual main plot.
It goes the other way because the whole investigation that they do is hinged on the idea that she didn't actually kill herself and was murdered, but it turns out at the end she did actually kill herself because she saw the actor who she thought was her biological father getting it on with the imposter who she thought was
this is where the sentence, you cannot be said in one sentence. A producer covers up a murder by, like, he hires thugs as well. So
you can't. You're right. Stop crying.
The point has been made.
We'll be here for hours.
And it's an investigation about a corpse that has turned up, essentially, isn't it? A female has been murdered or killed herself, and we need to find out why or how and who's involved.
Yes.
And it's complicated, and everything sort of links and tangents into things.
As Perry said, if you have questions, hesitate to call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think if this was another type of film with as convoluted a plot, I would have just tuned out and given up on it. But I think because of the performances and the writing and just how colourful the film is generally, it's even though there were times when the plot was frustrating, I will probably just watch it again to see if I can piece it together while I'm now also enjoying what is happening as well.
Yeah, it's definitely you've got comedy. And you got thrills, and you're trying to follow the narrative. And it's a lot to concentrate on.
I think the comedy and the charm of it is enough to carry it through that initial viewing and ignore how complicated the plot gets.
Yeah. Also, moment by moment, like I would say, moment by moment, you know what's happening. There's no point where you're like, why did this happen? Because you understand from the perspective of the characters what's happening. If one of them loses a finger and they need to go to the hospital, we get it.
Yeah.
If one of them falls asleep and is, like, in the back of a car that gets driven somewhere, we understand. If some henchmen turn up and intimidate, we get it because we're in the investigation. You might not put it together. Come together.
Gives you, or each little act gives you something to hang on to that is the specific driving force of that particular part of the film that then leads you on to the next part of the main plot. And you can almost safely ignore the main plot if that's not going to frustrate you and just concentrate on it scene by scene and watch, you know, Harry just kind of go through this nonsense that he's going through.
Well, like you touched on the visual style. It's a very colour. The colour of the film is obviously deliberate. Like, so the lighting skews towards oranges and blues and kind of at no point is anyone in daylight lit properly. It's kind of nighttime because it's noir, like dark literally, but also like it's party scenes and bars.
Yeah.
They always find an excuse to have the lighting be a little bit coloured one way or the other. What did you guys make of that visualist side of it?
Yeah, it's very slick and nice. It's pretty well done for his first job as director. So he's obviously picked up a lot of.
It had a pretty low budget too.
That too, yeah. So he's obviously picked up a lot of tips over the years. But yeah, it does make up for it in style. It's very fast pace. It has the interesting kind of opening credits as well. Very kind of catch me as you can esque kind of Bond film kind of thing.
Mm. I actually thought it was really interesting to watch the opening credits and the kind of silhouette cartoon style, and then a year later Casino Royale came out and had a very similar opening credit style of that kind of rotoscoped silhouette.
Oh, yeah.
But as I was going to say, like film noir in general has always been a very kind of stylistic genre where they do tend to play with lighting and shadows and stuff like that. And it's just comes on from that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess because it's a neo-noir, it makes sense that this one's a bit more neon. And then obviously the 40s noirs were usually black and white because of the technology. And so it's a visual upgrade of what they were already trying to do, which was be visually striking and have the shadow and dark and light work. And then this one, it's done with added colour. I think it's effective. And it's trying to be contemporary and fun and play with the genre as well, so I think that's a factor. Was that, Abby, something you liked about it as well? Was it the visual style along with liking Downey Jr.? Or, like, was that a factor?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, across the board, there is stuff I like about this film. So the script is strong, the way it looks is good, the performances are good. All of the qualms I have with it are really quite minor, and they're just little quibbles.
What specifically, Abby, are parts you think actually kind of aren't as good about this film?
Well, it's not parts per se, it's just a little like frayed edges, I guess is the way that I'll put it, but it's like how Jamie mentioned earlier, it gets a little bit slow in the middle but then it picks up again, and the actor who Corbin Burnson, who was playing Harlan Dexter, the plot was about him a lot but he wasn't really in it at the same time.
It suffered from us not knowing, because it's keeping the mystery. Because we don't know, if we knew about him, it would spoil the solution to the crime, I guess. So, but I feel like the answer isn't very satisfying, because, like, well, who's this guy? What's that going to do with anything?
So
he's somewhat incidental.
So I get it, but at the same time, you could feel the vacuum where he should be.
Yeah.
But you also, you don't need it. You couldn't say exactly what it is that he should have been doing.
Yeah.
There is one question that I was left with. When Robert Downey Jr. kills him at the end, like, he shoots him, and it's a great moment because it makes a reference to his, like, magician skill with his hands, because he catches the gun and then shoots him, and his last line is, "Captain fucking magic," before he dies. But were there no consequences for the fact that Robert Downey Jr. murdered a bunch of people?
Yeah, he reacts like when he's like, "I killed someone," and he's like, he was doing it in self-defense, and it's a big issue for him. And then after a while, it's like, fuck it, all the heads.
Well, I don't know.
Die.
I like the fact that it got less traumatic the more he did it. But
it's got some spectacular deaths. Like at one point, just a Nacho Stand guy gets pissed off and murders one of the hitmen after a skirmish on a bridge, and like there's a whole action sequence where Val Kilmer's in danger and he's being rescued by the woman, and then when a Nacho guy steals the kill, it's like, okay, I didn't expect a Nacho guy to go nuts.
Well, you know, it's LA, isn't it? But I mean, but I liked his, because when that initially happened, I thought, shit, was he in on the thing with Val Kilmer? No, he just goes, "How do you like that, you fucking animals? Goddamn cocksuckers," and just storms up.
It is great how once he's become a serial killer, there's no consequences to all the murders he's... Because it's like, he's done the thing of like, well, I dusted off the gun and gave it to a person who could have done the killing. It's like, I don't know, what if the police investigate and find something fishy? Like, or, you know, I'm sure some of these crimes, these murders could have come back and bite him on the ass.
I just kind of assumed, because I don't think the film ever explains it, but I assumed it was because of the contacts that Perry has after that point.
It is both the context and the contacts.
Yeah.
Because he does mention it. Perry does say in passing, like, you're lucky you're not in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's you know, that using that as a criticism is kind of nitpicking.
Mm. Well, it knows it's a movie, so it gets away
from exactly.
We're being a movie. This is what happens.
Because it obviously scales up the action to ridiculous levels as it goes on purpose.
Yeah. Well, also, Downey Jr. keeps getting shot himself and recovering. He gets his finger comes off, he's shot in the first robbery.
Let's not forget his balls getting fried.
He does get his balls electrocuted, but he sets that up by saying, "Oh, I'm glad we've wrapped up this investigation." Like that normally in the books, they get a torture scene, and then he'd kill 16 people and escape, and then it's like, and then so Downey Jr. has to get tortured and kill some people before this.
Oh shit! How many people does he kill?
I don't think he kill. He doesn't kill 16. There might be six people who die. No, it's quite high. A lot of people die. I'm not sure if they did do that.
It'd be interesting to rewatch that and try and keep a count and see if... Because it's that kind of film where they do set... You know, like the... come back to Edgar Wright again, where he foreshadows what's going to happen in a film before it happens.
It does it in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way as well, so it's not really obvious. But you can never guess where this film's going, despite it playing on tropes.
Yeah, another nice Val Kilmer scene, too. Where Robert Downey Jr. is getting his balls shocked, and Val Kilmer is implying that the torturer is gay and trying to get him to come over and take a look at his dick, and it turns out there's a small gun hidden down there, Willy Dynamite style. And
exactly. That's a nice callback to Willy Dynamite we've just reviewed, where he keeps a gun in his pants. And the other nice film reference was to Anthony's choice of Xanadu, where...
Oh, yeah.
This film weirdly brings up as a kind of joke the actor from Xanadu and name drops him because it's kind of a gay guy thing to watch. That's a nice Easter egg for us, personally.
Yeah.
There was a similar gag in The Long Kiss Goodnight about having a crotch gun as well. So there's another little reference as well.
I also liked Robert Downey Jr.'s two things in that scene. One where he screams, "Stop helping," because the guy's shocking him more. But also the other one after the guy is, the torturer is shot, where he says, Val Kilmer says, "Straight guys never check for weapons there. Or homophobes never check there for weapons." And then Robert Downey Jr. says, "Well, thank God it was a gun, because I thought that was just like a gay thing. It's something you guys can do."
That's one of the most stupid things he says. Like a lot of the time,
well, he's kind of frazzled at that point, I think.
In fairness, he has had his balls electrocuted. There's loads of scenes where if you just say them, they're hilarious. Like, the very climax has a moment where, like, Val Kilmer tries to save Downey Jr. and he gets shot, but he gets shot through. Like, they both get shot. Like, so it's one of those things where I'll stop the bullet, or the bullet's gone through and hit us both. Yeah. And then that scene culminates in, like, a car crash where a van goes off, like, a van that's been in a chase kind of goes off the edge of a bridge, and the coffin goes flying with the corpse of the victim. Yes. And then he has to fall off the bridge to stop being hit by a car. And he's dangling from a coffin on a road sign, holding the arm of a corpse with a gun on the top of the, you know, like it's a ridiculous thing.
Oh,
and then he has to catch the gun and kill everyone. And it's just
the escalation of that final scene I thought was fantastic. And it's also for a first-time director who's obviously been steeped in the action genre with Lethal Weapon and stuff, he's obviously learned a lot because the action sequence is really well done.
I love the fact that it's cool as fuck, but it also is ridiculous and farcical. Like it's like the way he does it. He's kind of in the shit. He's like dangling from a corpse's arm on a sign on a bridge, and then he shoots the guy really cool, and then the guy says something naff but funny, like you said, Jimmy. Yeah. Then he falls on the car that's trying to with another assassin in, and he kills that guy. And it's badass, but it's also he's a bit crap doing it.
Yeah, I know. There are so many little things like it's the same scene as well where he finds why do I keep forgetting her name?
Harmony.
He finds her. And she's okay. She jumped off the bridge and she's kind of dazed, but she's all right. And she goes, "Oh, you've been shot." And he says, "Do you want to see something cool?" And he pulls out the book. And
she's like,
"It's it stopped the bullet. And then she puts her finger through it, and he like reveals that he's been shot, and he's like, eh, not really.
Like, no, it went through Val Kilmer and the book. Yeah. And it's still through me, and I'm going to be in a lot of pain.
There is now bullet and book in me.
Yeah. But what was really, like, there's so many little things. The fact that Val Kilmer's ringtone is I Will Survive.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and then the fact, because I didn't even think about that. I just thought, gay joke. And then, so when he got shot and the blood comes out of his mouth, I thought, fuck, he's dead. And I was genuinely sad. Like, I think that's another strength of the film as well. The few genuinely emotional moments it has are quite affecting because everybody's so likable. The point where Robert Downey Jr. is his finger's eaten by the dog. But he's still in shock.
Well, he could have killed the dog, Abby. The dog lives.
The dog lives, yeah. I know. But I'm also not sure that a dog that nice would just eat a finger.
Well, it doesn't, does it? But but the fact that he's sitting there, and that's funny, and then he realises he's killed someone, and he breaks down, and the dog consoles him. And I wanted to cry at that point. I was like, oh my god.
Well, the whole film is a roller coaster of what the fuck's happening, emotions. It's funny, it's thrilling, and you never quite know when it's through because it's like, where's this going? You never know. Like, it has the few endings where it sums up what happened, and he, like, for no reason almost, Val Kilmer goes and finds the father that abused her, like the victim in the film, and just slaps him about a bit in the old people's.
I like the fact that he was like, big tough guy, old man who can't defend himself. And Val Kilmer's reaction was, yeah, fuck off.
Yeah, you abused a little girl, so what do you, you know. And it's nice, and it just puts that in, and it kind of references the fact that, we've seen Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I like that.
We're not doing that. Like, it's very knowing all the time. It's chock full of jokes and moments and references. There's definitely a sense of value for money. Like, Shane Black has written in so much film references, so many jokes, and has come up with a really good plot that he's tweaked to be as complicated and as fun as possible. And then doing that while fucking with you and still surprising you is a really good job. Well done, I thought.
I think this is one of those films that is not for everybody just because of how much is in it.
It's not for people who like eating popcorn and picking their nose, is it? It's for people who have attention.
Yeah, like you really need to watch it. And I think it does, I know I keep coming back to Hot Fuzz, but I think there is a lot of similarity between the two. But I also think, like Hot Fuzz and any of Edgar Wright's films, and I would imagine, now that I think about it, a lot of Shane Black's stuff, particularly stuff he's directed after this, for people who did enjoy it, I could imagine it being better in subsequent viewings.
Yeah, so watch again, though.
Yeah, and I get the feeling, not just for the plot, but I get the feeling there's a ton of little jokes and references that I just didn't pick up on the first time, because there's so many.
Yeah, well, just us talking will remind us that, like, there's bits each one of us has come away and gone, that was really great. And we go, oh, yeah, I didn't even... now you mention it, the ringtone and the reaction the woman has, and, you know...
I also think...
There's micro characters in there that are funny as well that we haven't even talked about yet.
The developing relationship between Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr. in the film is great as well. I like that there are a lot of moments where they act and talk like an old married couple who just bicker.
Yeah.
And I really like them limping through the hospital. And Val Kilmer's whole thing about that guy, the nurse, he doesn't even know he's gay. Look at the way he walks.
Anthony, what other things about this film kind of stood out for you as like a sign that it's good, or like, you know, are there other elements perhaps that you would like to talk about? Because I realise we've skipped over great swathes of the whole thing, but, you know.
We have. There's one, I really liked the film, but there's just one major thing that kind of left a weird taste in my mouth. And it's like, I know why it was there, because again, it's kind of playing with the conventions of noir. And it's just the kind of the horrible, dark incest mentions that happen, and it's kind of, there's always a kind of really sinister thing in a crime noir, where that's always revealed, and it's like, oh, okay, that's horrible. I can see why this is happening, kind of thing. But I don't know. To me, it didn't quite feel right, because this film was so fun and kind of. entertaining. Yeah. It did kind of leave a little bit of a weird taste in my mouth. How Harmony would just kind of like mention over that her sister was being like touched up by her dad,
and then she's
just
got...
how her sister's kind of thing culminates of her seeing some what suspected incest and then killing herself. It just
yeah, it's fucked.
Yeah,
it's odd. Sorry, Abby.
Because they did know each other when they were younger. I don't know if Harry maybe either knew or suspected something about that already, and that's how she could be so candid about it. It's not clear exactly what relationship they had when they were younger.
Yeah, like friends, but they've drifted apart.
Oh, well, that another thing that took me out of the film was when it was revealed that they were childhood friends.
Yeah.
That didn't ring true to me. I don't know.
But
maybe
her name
just
is
the way...
Harmony. See, because it's harmonious serendipity, huh?
Indeed, but I don't know. It just didn't ring true, and it kind of took me out of the moment when that happened. Kind of like, well, a bit.
I don't know. I think that was set up. I think set up at the magician scene right at the beginning.
Oh no, it was set up, but you wouldn't recognize your old childhood crush.
Well, he does.
Plus, there's clearly like 10 years between them, so they could never have been in school at the same time.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know, that just it's nitpicking, it really is. Yeah. But just that one moment kind of took me out of it a bit.
In response to that, generally, that character of Harmony, she is in on a lot of the slapstick and fun and the banter a lot of the time, which is good to have, like, the third main character be a woman who's not, you know, just a victim, you know, like, she's not... You know, Princess Peach. She is part one of the three, and is part. And she's very proactive. She's firing guns herself and getting.
I think she's also as you know, potentially good or bad as two guys are.
Yeah, and the trouble is, her sister has killed herself because she thought her birth father and her adopted father molested her, and she thought that her birth father molested, like his. Daughter, like it's so. Her sister is dead. Downey Jr. is peeing on the corpse and trying to get dumping the body. It's like she cannot be in on the fun of this. For her, it's deeply traumatizing and sad.
No, that was the other girl.
Yeah, that wasn't her sister. Okay, that was the fake.
At no point does Harmony's sister get peed on or mutilated or dumped or anything. That's the other poor girl.
Yeah.
That died.
She has a sister somewhere that we should all feel sorry for.
I think this is the just and again, I know everybody says that like any faults they can find with this film for the most part are just nitpicking. Yeah. And I think stuff like that, like the incest thing is very dark, but I think they did that to take a film that maybe they felt was almost too light and just add some weight to it.
And to make you not care that the bad guys are dead.
Yeah, the fact that they're there so little, they have to have done something really awful to like justify it.
Like
but also
boneheads in the case of the hitmen. They're just assholes. That's
I love those two hitmen as well. But and also the whole thing about the corpse that they mistreat and Robert Downey Jr. pisses on it and all this stuff, like. That to me was funny, but it's in the same way of, like, Bruce Campbell's character in the Evil Dead films is constantly just in the shit because it was funny to Sam Raimi to bully him.
Sure.
Like, it's that kind of mean streak sense of humour that is sometimes just funny, as long as it doesn't take it, you know, to the point, to the extreme.
Yeah, because it's not a tonal problem. It's a little odd, but then the whole film is not very plausible.
Yeah.
So... And like you said, Anthony, it's a micro nitpick thing, really. It's if you're being super critical, you can totally let it go because you know it's a film.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting you say tonal. Actually, this is probably one of the few films that we've had that is tonally consistent all the way through.
Yay!
one other thing before we properly wrap up. The whole Christmas thing, and particularly there's like a nightclub where loads of weird performing arts people in boxes with costumes. It's like really creepy candy cane men in leotards and like wimp strippers dressed up like creepy like reindeers. And there's so many performance arts nightclub things in boxes in a Christmas party. It really freaked me out. And Danny Jr.'s character's just standing looking at him going, yeah, your job is to do this and I'm just gawping at you.
It is L.A.
You need a pretentious candy cane human party.
Yeah.
That was also one of Robert Downey Jr.'s jobs when he was younger.
What, being a candy cane? A candy cane manipulating itself in a box to freak you out?
I don't know if it was that specifically, but he was one of those weird performance artists that they like to have in parties in L.A.
I'm drinking a cocktail, I'm looking at a man in a leotard molest another one, and there's a general creepy Christmas vibe. This is a good party. I'm having fun.
Well, someone also mentioned this. So when we went to watch Shane Black's other film, The Nice Guys, the other day, I kind of started noticing things that he repeats himself on. And like then kind of rewatching this again and then kind of doing a bit of research, there is a lot of things that he tends to bring up again, like Christmas. I actually looked this up because I noticed it's always Christmas in a Shane Black film, but it's never a part of the plot.
Yeah, because Die Hard's one of those classic, like, oh, it's Christmas, but you might not realise. And it's weird because Die Hard is like the it's kind of like the other, like there's Lethal Weapon series and there's the Die Hard series, and it's odd that Christmas plays a small part in them. In a set, like which do you, so which Lethal Weapon has? Because I don't even remember the Christmas element of Lethal Weapon.
That's the thing. It's in the first one, but you don't remember. It's not part of the plot.
Yeah,
I don't know. Christmas is a huge deal in Die Hard.
Yeah, well, Die Hard isn't a Shane Black film though.
Yeah,
it's just they're both the same cookie cutter. Like they're both fun series of a similar genre. That's why I brought it up, I guess. And that's the one I think of a Christmas. Like Jimmy says, it is a bit more obvious in that one. Are there other tropes of Shane Black that you looked up, or is that the
There's like, he just tends to kind of, if he's made a joke in one film, in the next film he'll try the kind of joke again, and it usually succeeds a bit better. Like there's a few I can think of, like in The Long Kiss Goodnight, there's a bit about someone having a crotch gun, and that kind of repeats in this. And then in this film, they kind of they try to get rid of a body by kind of chucking it out the window, and then it just kind of like falls, like it kind of breaks on a bin and kind of, and there's a similar thing in The Nice Guys where they try to throw a body over like a fence and it just kind of crash lands on someone's party.
Yeah. It's got a great sense of humor, like for just things you don't need to put in because they don't add to the story, but fuck it, we're putting them in anyway. There's a lot of visual jokes and visual interest with his films, and I for one appreciate it. I mean, I think we're getting towards the end. Are there any other points now? Abby, it was your pick. Are there things you think we've missed or anything else you want to bring up before we try to think how to rate it?
I think we've covered all of the main points that we wanted. So unless anybody's got anything else, I think maybe we should go on to the metaphors.
Yeah, that's fine with me. I'm trying to formulate one. So what I'm going to go with, right, I'm going to open us up on the... So I don't open us up, what the fuck do I mean? I'm gonna start us off with, it's like a really good Christmas party. Like... You go out, it's Christmas, you don't think you're going to have a great party, they're not usually brilliant, but you're just drunk enough, and you go to some places you didn't expect, you also do some classic things, so it's got the tropes of Christmas, and the tropes of films, but it's also got some surprises. It's a long night, you go to various places, you see some stuff you didn't think you were going to see, maybe some candy cane gimps, or some weird tinsel strippers or something. And you meet some people who don't like you. You meet some people who love you. You make friends. You make enemies. You have an insane night. Maybe there's, you know, some murders. And you go home and you sleep with the wrong girl. And, you know, it's like a proper wild Christmas party. And you look back at it with fond memories, but you wouldn't do it again. You wouldn't want to lose the finger. It's a bit like Hangover at times, isn't it, the film? You know,
yeah,
it's a wild, insane Christmas party But you feel a bit sick afterwards, and you don't remember it all properly, and you can't quite piece the story together. But you know, you look at the pictures again tomorrow, and you remember. Done. Tick.
Okay. I've got one.
Go on.
I think it was from Batman 1989, where the Joker had one of those guns that just shoots out the little, like, rod that's got that flag that says bang on it.
Yeah.
But then he also shot someone.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is what that film is, where it looks like one thing and it is, but then it also does the other thing as well.
That's good, because it's the gun, symbolic of the dark. Like, it's a gun that is comedy and a thrill. So it's that lovely, ironic combination that we've fucked with you. So, you know, you think, oh, thank goodness it was a fake gun. No, it is a gun. Fuck you anyway. You didn't expect that. Extra irony on top, isn't it?
Ha ha ha, oh shit, I'm dead.
Yeah, it's a perfect metaphor. Very succinct, Abby.
Yeah, thank you. I try.
Who's next?
I'll try one. It's kind of like, I don't want to fall back on the kind of like pick and mix kind of metaphor. I'm sure we've used that before.
Yes.
But okay, maybe it's more something like, well, like, the film was directed by, a first-time director who had been kind of out of favour for 8 years, and, like, the main cast is other kind of actors kind of who have been in the wilderness for a fair few years. Mm. And, like, they've all come together and they've made this film. It's a kind of situation where there's a lot going on, and a lot, I don't like a lot of the ingredients. And yet, right, somewhere in the middle, it all came together and it made a perfect cake.
Yeah.
It's a bit like when you hear what's in a carrot cake, you go, that can't possibly make anything nice.
Mm.
And then it does, if you like carrot cake.
But then it kind of doesn't work, because I don't necessarily think any of the ingredients were that bad. Personally, I'm kind of talking on more of a kind of Hollywood executive kind of thing. But there is a lot going on. It's kind of hard to describe the film as one genre. I mean, it's a crime noir. It's buddy cop thing at times.
Yeah.
There's so much going on.
It's
hard to fathom how all of this is going to come together in one cohesive pie that you can eat. But no, there it is. I take my hat off to it.
Your Christmas cracker party hat. I would say, like, that made, when the way you described it, it's like a kind of, like, a punch you'd have at maybe my Christmas party that I've had. And it's all of the different drinks, and you go, this isn't going to work. And then it's fine. There's a nice buzz from it. The flavour is not rancid. Like, and all the individually, the drinks would be fine. Mixed together, you have reservations, and then it comes together and works. So yeah. It made me think of, like, a punch, to be honest, rather than a horrible Christmas pie. Maybe not. You didn't say Christmas, in fairness.
No, I'll take it. It's a spiked punch.
Yeah.
Ooh. Sorry, my dog.
Has he become a motor car?
It was a very big yawn.
So, Jamie, your last.
This, being as it's a comedy, it made me think of the, because we've just recently done Man on the Moon about Andy Kaufman. Mm-hmm. This is like the film version of one of those comedians, someone like Andy Kaufman, or for a British reference, I guess, someone like Stuart Lee, who plays around with the idea of performing comedy. And there is general appeal in there, but there's more appeal to someone who knows what that person is playing around with.
Yeah.
So this is like the film equivalent of someone like Stuart Lee or Daniel Kitson or Andy Kaufman, who takes familiar elements of performing comedy in front of an audience and messes with it in a way that still makes a general audience laugh, but in a way that kind of winks at the people who are more familiar with the technique.
Yeah, the film plays with the form of a noir film and knowingly fucks with it and keeps you guessing. And those comedians, you don't know when they're being serious or fucking with you, and they are challenging the form itself on an extra level, aren't they?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Because so it's really clever clogs. It's like a comedian's comedian.
It's one of those fucking postmodern wanky bastard comedians. I think it has general appeal.
Yes.
I think it's a film it's a shame because no one gave it a chance, I think.
Well, it's change the title is what I say.
Yeah, but also it has that kind of niche appeal for dorky, insufferable film nerds like us.
Yeah.
Because it has things like tropes and cliches. Yes. And other things I learned in university.
And characters are nice, progressive, gay characters that we can get on board with instead of cliched, shitty, mocking ones.
Yep.
Yeah. And instead of sleeping with a woman, they subvert that. So it's both funny and an important change in cinema.
Yeah. It's a progressive film.
Yeah. Okay, good. And we all liked it, more or less. You've heard what we said about it. Check it out. And I think we've all signed up as Shane Black fans now. Until he steps out of line and we go, I did not care for that one. But I think we're all
going to... Mr. Black.
I think more power to Shane Black based on the films we have seen of his. And I look forward to seeing more in the future. But thank you, Abby. Good choice. We didn't make a suffer through weird rollerblading muses or horrible unicorns or anything.
Hey, they were both
my choice. Well, we've had unicorns turn up more than once, in fairness.
There's a unicorn in there.
Oh, yeah, one of those was mine, sorry.
But yes, thank you, Abby, for a good film. That's all I'm saying.
You're welcome.
Thanks, cheers.
So, please join us next time or go to our Facebook page. And I think we're spoiler-filled on Facebook. You could just Google us.
I think. Brilliant.
I don't know why I'm saying I don't know, but I do update it with what the podcasts.
You're on your fucking admin. Yeah.
Yeah, are you
taking
the right one?
I figured instead of doing a pointless, never-ending goodbye where some of us quote things and we stumble over each other, I thought I'd do a nice professional podcast where we end by actually saying, you can follow us on Twitter or follow us. I can't do it, all right? So just one of you give one of the lines to the film and I'll say goodbye at the wrong time. I will keep rambling until Abby says, shut up, let's end this.
I don't remember any.
I'd rather fuck a watermelon. Wait, wrong film.
What's the other half of the one I said? It's your thingy at the moment, Anthony.
What?
Your subtitle thing on Skype.
Go. Sleep badly. Any questions? Hesitate to call.
Yeah, that was it.
You've already quoted that in the film.
Not the other half, though. I only said half the quote.
Yes, listeners. If you have any thoughts, opinions, or comments, hesitate to comment at our Facebook, Twitter, or on the WordPress page, and we will be happy. Please do that. I'm joking. Please actually comment. We're glad to hear from you. Mwah.
Love you. Kiss, kiss.
Oh, fucking hell.
Bang, bang.
Goodbye.
Bye.